So, after I found my conclusion, and what I would propose is this. The conclusion is, will take 2 or 3 minutes, and I'll briefly read that, and then I would suggest that instead of simply addressing questions to me, that we use the opportunity for people to speak to one another. I mean, I'm happy to try to answer whatever questions people wish to pose to me, but I would prefer if it wouldn't just be between myself and you, but could perhaps engage all of us, or at least most of us, in the conversation. So maybe some kind of larger conclusion is in order, and just to remind you, we've had a presentation of the possible historical Abraham, or the historical circumstances in which a man such as Abraham lived. We've had the presentation of several interpretations of Abraham from the period of about 1000 to 500 or 600 B.C. First, the historical Abraham, 2000 to 1800. Then the several interpretations that have been placed in the book of Genesis. Then we had the interpretation, especially among Jews, in the period from 300 to 100 or to 0 B.C. Then we had a discussion of the New Testament material, and now a discussion of that material which comes after that. As Father Arthur Peepcorn mentioned in me going out, it would seem that we need some presentation on the next period before the Reformation, but apparently none of us really extended ourselves in that way, which could have been interesting, and Professor Sauer pointed out that we might have had a Jewish and an Islamic interpretation. But setting my comments into that context, let me say that the Abraham of the Fathers, artistic, literary presentation, sketched in my presentation, and only two of a numbering different interpretations, was a new Abraham. In some ways, like that of earliest Christianity, is represented in the New Testament, and in some ways reminiscent of the Hellenistic Jewish Abraham, as pictured by Jubilees and Maccabees and Philo and Josephus and others, and in some ways, like the Abraham as sketched in the prophets or in Genesis, but a new Abraham who is distinctively different from all the earlier forms. He was a new Abraham, or several new Abrahams, because those who turned to him for enlightenment or for guidance were different people from those who proceeded. They lived at a different time, they had new tasks and responsibilities, they had a somewhat different vision of God and of his relations with men than had their predecessors, but they shared a common tradition and a common commitment to that tradition. One question which then could be asked is, does an interpreter of Abraham or a community's interpretation of Abraham at some later date have to go back through all of those? Is it possible to leap over? Let us say, bypass perhaps the Pauline interpretation or the interpretation of Hebrews and go directly back to Genesis. Is that desirable? Is it at all possible? How does one relate to that which is given and continues to live on from the past? What these observations on the interpretation of Abraham in the early church suggest is that the relationship between the interpreter and that which is interpreted is exceedingly complex. That is, it is not adequate to say that the interpreters, individuals or communities, preachers, catechists, teachers of any period were simply interpreting the biblical text. In fact, it is more accurate to say that they are appropriating the tradition through the text. That is, they are using the biblical text, and I use that positively, not exploiting, using the biblical text and the history which it records to interpret the reality of God and man in their situation, or to interpret the Christian faith in their situation the new one in which they live. So instead of interpreter and text, you have interpreter and text, of which there are many, and events which lie behind the text, and over all of that, you have God. So that in a sense, the interpreter is as much interested in God, who relates to him now in the reality of his time, as he is in both the text and that which the text points to. But it's an exceedingly complex relation. It's not one person here trying to find out what this meant here. But at least those four elements are present, it seems to me, in a person who comes out of our kind of religious background. Interpreter, text, of which there are many. One could add to that a kind of subpoint, the text which gives the first presentation of the historical events, then the event, and God. So the interpreter is as much interested, he is primarily interested in interpreting the reality of God and man for him and for his day, not simply in presenting what it was in the past. So as the times change in development, people find themselves in new kinds of situations. The primary elements then are not the interpreter and the text, but the interpreter and God and God's revelation to man in the historical record of his people. Now, it is only, I think, in modern times that men have gotten the idea that as interpreters they are somehow distant or distinct from the text. Now, this may be so if one were interpreting, let us say, the religion of ancient Egypt and its sacred books. Then one might be distant. But the interpreters of Abraham in antiquity, as those who live today, deal with the past as their own past. So they are not distinct or distant. They may be distant historically. And it is because of that conviction that they deal imaginatively, creatively, and boldly as they reinterpret the past. Because they are convinced that they worship the same God Abraham worshiped, they too believe and trust his promises, and they were in fact, or they are in fact, part of the same tradition they are interpreting. So the text and the historical events become signs, if you will, though please don't press that term, signs of their relation to God. People then stand in a dialectical relationship to the past, for just as the past has shaped them, they are reshaping it. The past lives on. History is what we are writing and thinking. It's not simply what took place. As Abraham was remaking their lives, so they are remaking his. And it is the boldness in remaking Abraham which is the surest sign of the life and vitality of any community, and specifically in our case of the early church. And that is the reason why their views on Abraham, though now some 1,500 years old, still interest us today. Thank you. Yes, sir.
So that I can see, understand this a little more clearly. What you were doing between 11 and 12 today, is that, would you say you were in this spot of the interpreter, or were you doing something different here? I just want to...
Well, I think that that's a very good question. I think that historical scholarship is, in fact, precisely that. Now, there is a sense in which it does another task, namely to try to plot out, as best can be done, what people thought and experienced in another time. But the fact that I live within the same tradition and care about it means that in the presentation of this, I clearly find things that speak to me, and I tend to probably emphasize those things. Not necessarily the ones that I picked out here, but there are certain ones that I will resonate to. So it seems to me that the way in which I would present, were I to continue on this material, would, I hope, be as much a statement of our own perceptions and mine in this age as it would be of the past, though I hope that it would be able to, in some sense, please people who have different kinds of concerns about it.
Well, I'm surely aware that my own faith, my own being, is involved in a choice. You know, it
I'm not trying to make an... I don't think an ultimate judgment is necessary about the meaning of Abraham. That's, I think, the point I made at the beginning. There is no one Abraham, even as a historical person. And I think there are so many different Abrahams. As a historical person, just like there are so many different Carl Gressers. I hope...
Well, now I don't understand what you're saying here, because I thought that when you talked about the interpreter, it was interesting, the reality of God and man today, and that this is really what you're saying. When you interpret this, it seems to me that you are making a judgment about ultimate reality for you.
Oh, certainly, in that sense. To be sure, I mean, I'm talking about God. I would consider that ultimate, certainly. And I think that Abraham is important for me in my talk about God. And so I would be more interested in contemplating Abraham than I would be in contemplating, the Buddha. He just is a more revelatory figure for me than he would be for somebody else.
Yes, sir.
You mentioned there's a dialect between the interpreter and the text. Now, what is the relationship between the text and the event? The text, essentially, calls it based on event, historical.
Yeah.
Or is it, are we back to the text because the community accepts it?
Well, that is probably the reason why we do, that it's historically speaking. But I think, as Ralph pointed out, really marvelously yesterday, if you, and would cross it earlier, if you have the events as best we can reconstruct them, certainly the broadest outline, you don't really get any interpretation of them in a religious tradition until many, many hundreds of years later. So the relation between them is, in this case, quite distant. It'd be quite different, I would say, than some of the New Testament writings that talk about the events surrounding Jesus. So that it would seem to me that because that is the case, one can see even more clearly how he relates to the historical person, that he does not relate to him simply through these events, through these documents, but the relation is, in a way, transcends those documents, because Abraham lived on before those documents ever came down.
But these documents imply the event, at least. So
yes, I mean, certainly, that's true. And I didn't think there was any question about the historicity of Abraham himself. Now, maybe there would be. I don't know that myself. But it seems to me... Huh?
I think Carl established that as a law.
Yeah. Just like the question of the historicity of Jesus, I mean, you know, that's... People might have to discuss that, but it's really not a very interesting question. You know, it's not too likely that he did not live. But I think, you know, that... So you're not talking about a figure that did not exist, and the meaning is then simply a creation of a religious community. The meaning is, in some sense, not a historical person.
I had an aha in the earlier session when I raised my hand, and I don't know, it's not very profound, but when Shreya raised this question about what you seem to be saying. The big thing is to see how the fathers apply the text. You raise the question, is there a right or wrong application of the text? I suddenly related this to two old ethical categories and arguments between deontologists and teleologists, between people who, if you ask the question, how do I know what I should do, say there are certain laws that are categorical that determine this, and I look for wherever that source of law is. And then on the other hand, there are those who say, well, I know what's good by determining what works in the context in which I find myself. And I guess the one point I want to make is, it strikes me as to make those antithetical is to ruin both of them at the same time, because unless God is totally arbitrary, for example, in ethics, totally arbitrary and just does things for the hell of it, he is doing it. The Sabbath was made for man, so that the teleology enters into the question of the deontology and vice versa. So I'm sort of saying one thing is I hate to see the argument go where we have to settle on one side or the other as far as application as over against the right word and interpretation. On the other, good example of this, I think, is dogmatic rigorism, where you simply divorce yourself from historical context and put the formulae words into it, and people believe in formulae. The other is black theology, where at least Cone in one place says, only that which speaks to black experience is valid. In the one, you have made it magical incantation. In the other, you have taken experience and made it normative, so that anything that works for you is the gospel. Okay, those are the extremes. Well, but don't we still have to refine it and say, well, which has priority? Which has the critical priority in terms of testing? Agreed that there's a correlation between the right word and the situation. And I think at this point, as theologians, the question resides in the gospel.
Right, well, you've got to ask the question again. I mean, in our period here, what is it that they were concerned about? And they were concerned about the right interpretation of Abraham. They were concerned as to whether the Judeo-Christian tradition was God's revelation. And it was in that sense they found it necessary to make it clear that that was the case for Abraham as well. So it isn't a question of the rights or wrongs of Abraham. It's what they were trying to communicate to the world in which the Christian movement was just initially making its way. So in that sense, what is the right or wrong interpretation is whether Abraham is part of this revelation of God's grace to mankind. And in that sense, they give a profoundly orthodox, central Christian affirmation that we're not going to exclude. That's a right or wrong interpretation. The wrong interpretation in this kind of view would be to say he's not part of it. So I think you have to refine it to what level they are really speaking, and not a question of just whether you think Abraham means this or means that. But he's part of a large religious worldview that was being worked out then, having to do with God, man, and the world.
Yeah, but you seem to be saying there is a norm within a norm under which all of them...
Norms change from time to time. I think that we have to recognize that, you know, what one person at one time considers to be normative in the way he decides it is different from another person at another time, and there is no ultimate way of doing that in every generation. There is not one central, I think, meaning to the Christian reality. It's just too rich for that. And at certain times, people will pull out one thing and say, that is central. At one time, it's to say something about the very nature of God and about how sublime he is in comparison to all things else. And other times, to say something about very specific historical things. And that changes. But the continuity remains. In other words, the continuity in the Christian tradition is not maintained, I think, by a single idea. That's putting it, I guess, and I think that, for that reason, is an extraordinary freedom. And that's why the tradition has been so extraordinarily creative.
Well, I don't want to pursue it. I'll just make my last statement, Bob. And then when I hear you talk that way, then I hear myself in a teleological bag to such a degree that just my saying it by virtue of my sincerity makes it a valid confession.
I'll put it that way. Well, I certainly didn't imply that or even suggest it. I mean, because you're dealing with large forces that have moved many men at many different times. It's not an arbitrary kind of thing, you know. And to see clearly, you know, Athanasius at one point said very clearly, it's got to be this way. And most Christians since then have thought that was so. But most Christians at the time did not think it was so. But it's only after many, many centuries that we have seen, I think, the fundamental rightness of his statement about the nature of God. You know,
I think just reflecting as a guy in the field, our arbitrary, well, maybe not arbitrary, but our limiting revelation or insight, whatever word you want to use, to a particular body of books has really impoverished our awareness of the richness of what we have. And tracing to a man like Abraham, or I noticed there were books or a book by Moses, you know, that we just have closed our eyes to all kinds of opportunities to see the richness. And what we've done, at least when I came through the seminary, what we did is we plopped out for a little while the Old Testament out of historic context, then we leaped over into some New Testament text, and then we ricocheted through the Reformation into the present, some, well, ancient lodge in the 17th century. there was, we lost all of the areas you're talking about, and Dr. Nicholsberg talked about last night, you know, and I think we are really impoverished by that, what I consider now to be, maybe arbitrary, but a terrible limitation of the awareness of the richness of our tradition. And one of the, at least one of the salutary effects of this conference for me is the awareness that there's more than I have seen.
It's true for me as well.
The thing that really worries me is that maybe this tradition that we're discussing is quite narrow. What's the relation between Abraham's world and the Far East, the cultures of Japan, China? Do you see any relationship at all?
He'll be here in a little while. Maybe we can hold that up.
I tend to think historically, Norm, I think for most of our discussion, it's important to see him as part of this tradition, which we call Western, but which goes back to a much broader base in the Near East. And now, insofar as he is employed by Islam, he has been put to a wholly different use than we have put him. And it's conceivable that one could do that elsewhere, and maybe it's been done. I doubt if it has been done. But that is, it seems to me, the nature of the historical experience that man has. Now, I think maybe one of the questions that should be asked, and this isn't a question of whether we want to keep Genesis or not, but is whether we want to even bother to create a new image of Abraham. That is he the kind of person who we want to sort of work at, to work for us in whatever situations? I think that's a legitimate question. Now, that isn't to say a question of trying to dismiss Genesis, because the fact is that there are all kinds of people in the Bible that we don't pay any attention to. And who we pick out at one time is dependent on a lot of things. So maybe the first question is, you know, really, do we want to sort of work at Abraham? Ed?
How would you suggest, from your point of view, one goes about even answering that question, yay or nay, the very last one you formulated?
Well, I think the first thing is that if he's there and he has some life at the present time, that's a good indication that it's worth thinking about. So that's the first thing one would try to gauge. And I think Abraham might, in fact, do that. And then it would seem to me that, you see, I think one of the difficulties is that we don't want to think about it as too intellectual. Can we sit down now and shape a model and we ship him out to people and start creating? It has to come out of some kind of larger, as I say, experience of people. And if Abraham can become such a symbol because of the way in which people discover in him those things which they today see important as members of that same tradition that goes back to him, then I think he begins to emerge as someone worth looking even more closely at. But it isn't as though, you can't decide it. You don't sit down and say, well, maybe let's kind of work up Jacob, you know, for this 100 years. It doesn't go that way. And my impression is that on the basis of what I learned in going through this material, that I was really not the least bit interested in Abraham. When I got that letter from Krentz last summer, it sounded like it'd be fun to come and, you know, do something in the conference. So I said, all right. And it wasn't until the last couple of months that I began to find him so fascinating. You know, I mean, I think I could see myself now. I will. I mean, I will talk about Abraham and use him in my courses and in a way that I never did before. And maybe some of you will. And maybe the variety of his, you know, his life experience means that you can really come into him at so many different places. He is universal, you see, in that sense. In the way in which other men are not. There's a potential of being universalized because his experiences are so universal and human, even though he's... Yes, sir.
The history of exegesis has been sketched out. It's certainly shown that the vehicle, the formal and the vehicle by which a story is retold changes in the Jews and Christians share the midrashic form. It moved over into an allegorical form and went in this way. I wonder if the other
hand, although one can show at each time how Christian exegesis has appropriated the literary forms to tell its story. But nevertheless, there is a continuity that emerges in the picture of Abraham, which can be seen with great flexibility, but when set over against Judaism or Islam, one can see certain contours. Indeed, there are areas of overlap. But basically, there's a family resemblance. So Augustine's picture of Abraham is not the difference between that. He's not picturing Humpty Dumpty.
Exactly.
And it seems to me, in that sense, we begin to say that there is this Christian understanding. At times, the church, from within the church, someone will picture something, and the church will react by saying, no, that's heretical, that's Gnostic, or something like that. So it does seem to me, over against the freedom, one has to recognize there are some inner controls. In the controversy between Jews and Christians, each different generation, I think often we play dirty fool by bringing in a wrong set of criteria. In the recent period, Christians have attacked Jews by bringing in the historical critical method and torpedoing their Midrashic view. But if you pick that away, it seems to me that basically where the discussion is most profitable is when both of us are talking within this dialectical process you outlined, namely coming to a text from an understanding of reality and having that text shape the reality from which we come. And in that sense, it's ultimately the theological, Christological argument that is at stake.
Yeah, I would agree, and I think just to comment and not so much to answer what you said at the beginning, you could not make Abraham into a polytheist. Now, one would say, well, most Christians aren't interested in doing that. So, but if you look from the inside, it may look one way, but if you look from the outside, there are certain things he cannot become. And I think that's very well put. So.
Yeah. The last 2 days, some of us here have been trying to share with you how we understand how the community of faith in the past has understood Abraham. In other words, trying to interpret texts in the past. Now, you have suggested in the last little while that an interpreter looks through the text at the past event and he stands within the context of his own reality. Now, that's a very practical question. In a little while, the purpose of this conference is supposed to shift to, I think, the conference doing what we've been saying the people in the past have been doing. And it's a sort of a simplistic question, but could you sort of, in a very practical, concrete way, say how this should happen? Not by giving an example of interpretations, but a kind of a method and a kind of sketching out how this conference is now going to stand in the position of interpreter. Do we have one foot in 20th century America? Can you sort of make a scenario for the kind of thing that should be happening for the rest of the time?
Well, I certainly am not going to suggest that even that would foreshorten a discussion. I mean, it seems to me to be very important to get feedback at this point, so...
Well, I mean, the method.
The method?
Yeah.
All right, I can think of one method that I use in teaching it, and we got a small enough group here. We can do it in two groups, you know, is use a group method where everybody has to say their piece. So instead of having the more articulate and bold people who talk out all the time, then let everybody in the circle, we could have two or three circles, each person has to say what he thinks about Abraham on the basis of what's been said, and then we go on.
And how Abraham, if I met that, I mean, how Abraham hits me, is this the kind
I of... I think the first thing is to begin with people's impressions. What do you think about what's been said, and do you think it's worth talking about? And does it touch you any place, so that there's some place that we all can begin? And then from that, things would emerge. But I don't think that you have to, you know, say, how are you going to proceed? I think the important thing is that everybody gets a chance to give their initial impressions. And then it will become more disciplined as we move into a discussion. I think that could be very exciting.
That's Bob, I'm kind of fascinated by your God argument. What's the difference between you as a historian and you as a preacher?
Well, I do different kinds of things. I tend to talk differently in each situation. That is, if I'm talking to the preacher, I'm explicitly trying to say what this means for us, or you, or
you me. You have the same tree under the arch.
That's right. And I would say, as a historian, I don't tend to put it in those kind of languages, but I'm still talking about that which I call to, what I consider to be reality. And reality for me has something to do with God.
Does the historian ever find irrelevant reality?
Irrelevant reality?
Reality back there, but it's irrelevant now.
Well, there's a lot of things back there that's irrelevant. It's not a question of being irrelevant now. I mean, everything that takes place is not historical. Historical is what is remembered and passed on. So there are countless things that are happening right now in the lives of each one of you in this room that are not historical. They're not of significance for someone else unless you happen to maybe become significant. In other words, we don't, as historians, try to say everything that happened to everybody at every time and every minute and every day. By definition, a historian is picking a segment of experience that he thinks is of larger meaning. So in that sense, he is, certainly. And good historians, I think, I know, recognize that. We're talking about reality now. They may not want to talk about God, and it's very difficult to introduce God into a historical narrative, I grant. But it's hard to introduce him into most of the experiences that we have without, you know, being very, very sensitive in the way we express things. You know. So I don't want to push it, but I...
And one final historical question. In all of this, with the fathers, was there a canon?
Yes, sure. It was not completely settled, but for all practical purposes, you know that. I wasn't put to the point.
That's not quite as neat as that, maybe.
No, I couldn't imagine what. Say what you mean.
That's not the way an exegete talks.
What served as control? Not what you identify as control, but what John Chrysostom thought was control. What the man who made Abraham into a Christian Stoic saint thought was control.
He obviously thought what the Bible said was the control. And that's part of the difference I had with you this morning. I think the task of the historian is not to identify with the person he's interpreting. He stands in a different place than the person he's interpreting. And that's what it means to be, have Abstand, as the Germans say. And I think that has to be kept in mind, that if Origen thinks this is what the text means, my task as a historian is not to agree with Origen, it's to recognize that that's what Origen thought he was doing, and that's important for me to understand him, but I realize he's doing something different, so I'm standing at a distance. Ed?
I'd like to ask Ed Krantz to respond to Mr. Child's comment a moment ago. If there is indeed family resemblance, even though forms may change and there may be overlapping between the Midrashic form that a Christian interpreter uses with a Jewish interpreter, what is the family resemblance amongst the three, four New Testament pieces that are working with Abraham that you presented us this morning?
They all agree that Abraham is the father. And that what he is, in some way, is descriptive of what the Christian is.
Well, I'm almost zero as a Jewish scholar, but I'd say the first statement is what we Jews have always said, so that's not uniquely Christian. And apparently your Lord and Master at least disagreed with us in the way John records one dialogue there, and the whole issue is paternity and fatherhood. What's the unique family resemblance of your notion of Abraham as our father for us Christians? That's different from what we Jews say, that Abraham's our father.
There's no difference in the father concept. The only difference lies in the fact that the decisive event has taken place. I stand in the Judeo-Christian tradition as Christian. I therefore do not expect that sharp a break with the Jewish tradition outside of Pentecostal time.
I'm not
Peter, what are you talking about?
Outside of the fact that it's fulfilled.
Okay, but going back to at least the way John reports here, Lord, he said that we really didn't have Abraham as our father. He said, in fact, that the devil was our father. So he disagreed with us that I could even say Abraham's my father if I wanted to be the kind of Jew I am.
Yeah, so did George Fulbus last night. So did Fort Maccabees argue that not all Jews are Jews. That is not uniquely Christian to distinguish that the physical progeny that goes back to Abraham is not necessarily Abraham's progeny.
Okay, then tell me why Abraham really isn't my father.
What?
Tell me then why it is that I'm deceiving myself when I say Abraham is my father. What is there about that that's deceptive? How am I faking myself out?
You say he isn't.
No, I say he is.
I am.
And I say your Lord doesn't do it. Hey, I'm trying to be a Jew, and I don't know enough about Jewish rabbinics or anything. If you're doing it, somebody else around here ought to try to pursue this. And maybe I still don't see the distinction. Mr. Charles said you could see if it's just Abraham is father, and Jesus is fulfillment. In other words, that's not enough specific concretion for me to even say, aha, now I at least see that there's the Christian family resemblance, and you put any one of that family up alongside of any one of the Jewish exegetical family, and I can at least see the difference in profile.
You lost me on the exegetical profile there.
Why don't you, Mr. Child, I just use profile as the way most family resemblances are often marked, at least. Your brother up here said, looked at me when the hour began and said, yep, you're a Schrader, all right, I know your brother. You never saw me before, but apparently something about my physiognomy said that, yeah, I'm in that family. And I guess it was because I was standing this way, you know, he saw this hooked nose and this corny chin. And, he saw something about family resemblance. Now, or maybe that's not what you had in mind.
Well, I think that I wouldn't want to suggest that you can really, I do feel that the statement is right, that there is a family resemblance among all the various Christian witnesses. I wouldn't say that there's some that would be way out, but basically family resemblance. And that's the thing about family resemblance, that it's very hard to determine it in terms of conceptual differences. Everybody in the family describes their nose, and pretty soon every variety is there. And what makes the difference is when you sort of see them together in their given context, rather than to say, what really makes the father of a family is the blonde hair, because there's always one that has black hair at the end. But seeing in the life of in the growth of the Christian church over against the synagogue, there is quite a different way of looking. Obviously, there are very clear-cut distinctions. I mean, if you compared Augustine with Maimonides, it'd be quite clear that it's a totally different understanding. But I do think that one has to take seriously the living community of faith, to be a Jewish or Christian, by which to see how in a given situation they understood their self-understanding, their existence over against Abraham.
Does John Corbin have another question to you this morning? It seemed to me that an awful lot of what you said could have been said and wasn't, point of fact, said in some of the text I was talking about last night. And that as I read Jewish texts, as I read the New Testament, I find, you know, figure, let's say 95% of what I find in the New Testament, I can find in Jewish texts. The important thing that I find in the New Testament that I don't find in the Jewish texts is our Lord Jesus Christ, who I believe is God's decisive act. Now, the point is that having said that, and the New Testament church having made Christ the kind of magnet that attracts all of this stuff, it seems to me that one can't necessarily point to everything in the New Testament and say, this is Christian. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob sitting at the table and all the boys around them. You can find it in Jewish texts. And I think Ed's point is very much the point, which is that we stand in a Judeo-Christian tradition. And Abraham is our father. And whether Christ comes in explicitly at any point, I'm not so sure. I think the point is that Christ is the fulfillment, he is the ultimate act, which I have to implicitly keep in mind. but I'm not sure that I can't expound Abraham in a way that would be very Jewish. I think one of the things that Robert has done all day here is to show how, if you want to say it, how Jewish a lot of patristic interpretations are, in the sense of the contours, the emphases that are being brought out. That doesn't mean that Origen is a Jew. He stands on the other side of Christ. So I'm not sure that even a Christian has to be exclusively, or that being exclusively Christian has to be non-Jewish. I think you're trying to develop a polarity between Jewish and Christian that just doesn't exist, and that historically can't exist, because the church is historically a continuation of, or one continuation, there are two, or even three if you want to bring in the Muslim continuation to the Jewish tradition. But I think you're trying to develop a polarity that historically just doesn't hold.
Well, I certainly wasn't trying to deny, you know, the Jewishness of the New Testament roots and the New Testament documents. And I guess your second last sentence is the one that I'd still like to get somebody to unpack a little more clearly for me. For me, Judaism and Christianity are two descendants of Old Testament Israelite scripture. Judaism has got a longer tradition, goes back a couple hundred years, depending on when you think Judaism really started. If you can even put your finger on it, but at least in some place the term started being used first. And I suppose that sometime in exile or in sort of post-exile period. But and not trying to be Marxist, I would say, get all the Jewish stuff. No, I guess I'm saying, what's the difference between Jesus's or Matthew and John's Jesus Jewish interpretation of Abraham? That's at least clear enough so that when you sketch out in front of me, I can see, oh yeah, that at least is different from the Jewish interpretation of Abraham.
I'm not sure that there is any in the fact that
well, if there isn't, then I have found this
problem.
My family resemblances, that means are distinct enough that you can see that another one is in a different family.
I think it has to be said, the Jewish interpretation of Abraham, in spite of these somewhat very left-wing documents that George happens to read, that most Jews are not very... No, seriously, I mean that very seriously. Most of them, they're not considered really authentic Jewish documents. The Jewish interpretation is land and seed of Abraham. And there's no reason why we should kid ourselves and say that the Jew thinks it means to be a spiritual follower of Abraham. I think there's no question about that. I think it has to be said. And I think in relation to what you said there earlier, historically, it is not the case that Judaism and Christianity are complementary. They are exclusive. There have never existed Jewish Christians for any length of time in the history of Christianity. It has not been possible to be a Jew and a Christian. That has been excluded. Now, whether it should have been or not, that's not the way Christianity grew. And up to this day, it is not possible to be a Jew and to be a Christian at the same time. So historically, it works just the opposite. Now that's maybe too strong, but...
You see, some of the documents that George was using came before Christianity. Right. When Christianity came,
that's right.
And the Judaism rejected them because of the possibility to move in the direction of Christianity. So in a sense, that's to recognize the word both ways.
That's right.
Which is to say that Christianity, Judaism, became something other precisely because of Christianity.
Exactly, exactly. But they will never admit, though.
I think... Wait a minute. I think you have to be very careful. You really have to be very careful. Judaism became something else other than what we read about in what we call the Old Testament. But whether it became something else because of Christianity is a different question. I would say that the opinion of most historians is that the changes which take place, which lead to what we call Judaism in its historical form, were already long underway even before the destruction of the temple and were precipitated in large measure and formulated because of that, not because of Christianity. Now, whether that played a factor, it was a factor, but that both Christianity and Judaism, I think, has to be said. I think in this sense, Professor Charles really hit on the right. Both are new in the sense that they are both new developments that go beyond what we call ancient Israel, and neither can be identified with ancient Israel, neither Judaism nor Christianity. In that sense, they are both something other. But I don't think that you can say it's because of Christianity, except in a very limited way, unless we have some new kind of evidence that we don't have.
I want to talk less
realizing the problems of getting back to what he said, thought, and did, almost every Christian anyway would say that somehow my understanding of him is always corrected by the earliest testimony about him. So there's no question about that. Say the Nicene Creed has said more things, or that, say, 19th century liberal view of Jesus would say even different things about him. The most remarkable thing is that we're constantly being corrected by, let's say, the rediscovery of the apocalyptic eschatological world in which Jesus lived. Even though that doesn't mean we go back into an apocalyptic world, we realize that that somehow refocuses for us again and reshifts the direction.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, that's only what any historical study does. So that, for instance, if we would say Luther or Calvin and see their Christology, that would, again, redirect us, and constantly does. Although I think we Christians say that something about the life of Jesus himself that we could discover, or the New Testament, somehow affects the direction of our thinking in a remarkable way.
Mm-hmm.
Would this analogy offer any insight now into trying to figure out what is what are the parameters, what are the boundaries of viable interpretations of Abraham? I guess pretty well established yesterday that there's very little about his life that could ever serve as a corrective, unless much more information comes to light, because we can really say not much about his life. Would you say that, is there a sense in which, say, the Old Testament now, for both Christian and Jewish communities, functions in that kind of corrective sort of thing, and in the sense that while we have the ongoing tradition, we also have that initial tradition which leapfrogs over everything and says, oh, come on back this way a little bit closer?
I mean, without speaking directly to Abraham, because maybe it hasn't been done as long, it's apparent that in the 1960s and the 1970s that Christians and Jews have discovered the social dimensions of Israeli prophecy. Now, it seems to me that is a way in which the biblical material comes alive in documents that we didn't pay a great deal of attention to. And it's, I think, part of the, again, not to overdo that word, the richness, you know, and the depth of the documents themselves that allow us constantly, as we find ourselves having new kinds of needs and demands, have the capacity to speak to those in a way which is authentic. And we recognize it as authentic. I think that would be an analogy rather than a specific on Abraham. And, you know, I must say, it's a question of confronting Abraham. I really find him to be fascinating. I didn't get a chance to read through Fear and Trembling again, but I think I will probably when I get back. And now some of the other people told me about other things. And I think that's the way in which it's done. Now, what it is that we will see in him, there may be some things that are very, very unique that really for us right now that we would like to kind of latch on to. And he's there sort of waiting. But it's because of the depth. See, that's part of also what it is. You know, I think that what... sorry to speak very broadly, but I think what religion means is, in one level, is simply have this element of depth in one's life. That he is not always driven to be living in this particular moment, this particular age, with all the things that impinge on him. And that if he wants to talk about it, what it means to be a real, genuine, authentic human being, he doesn't go to a movie star or somebody who writes in a contemporary magazine. He goes back 4,000 years and picks up this man, you know. Now that's death. I think that it might also work just the other way, and it certainly has. But it allows one to plunge the depths of his own being and a community to do that, I think. Now that's not all that religion is about. But that's one thing that's very important, I think, that Christians and Jews have always recognized. So that we can find this in Abraham,
It's, I think, a very important consideration.